Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. With me, Aidan Williams. I've got a special episode with a special guest today. Hero of Aston Villa, Wolves, Everton, Scotland, plenty more. But before we get to that legend of the game, let me introduce my equally legendary fellow Potter joining me this evening. From the Merseyside perspective, certainly of Andy's career, wearing his Everton top proudly there, we've got committed Evertonian Paul McParlan. You can take committed in any sense you like there, Paul. Evening, Paul.
Evening, really looking forward to this one this evening. It's going to be a fascinating conversation with, obviously, you know, one of the greatest footballers of the modern era.
Well, there we go.
Great show.
And we've already had Neville Southall, so, you know. There, our guest today is the one and only Andy Gray, a man who's both recognised and renowned for his unique talents as a footballer and then latterly, of course, for his outstanding skills as a football commentator and presenter in the Premier League years. Andy was the complete forward, as Paul was alluding to there, terrorising defences wherever he went, idolised by the fans of every club he played for, I think largely due to the passion and commitment he showed, as well as his goals, of course. He celebrated every goal he scored enthusiastically, just like the supporters on the terraces. Potentially even the best header of a ball in the modern game, I reckon. Always prepared to go when it where it hurt. A League Cup winner, FA Cup winner, Cup Winners' Cup winner. First Division League winner. It's an honour to have such a giant of the football world as our guest today. We look forward to listening to his recollections of his glittering career in football and his time commentating for Sky. Welcome, Andy Gray. Great to have you on.
Thanks, guys. Good to be here. You forgot that also a slight mistake there on one title win in Scotland as well. You didn't mention that, did you?
One title win in Scotland. Absolutely.
You know, it's one of those wonderful ways to finish a career, put it that way. So it was amazing. Yeah.
Well, yes, absolutely. Well, if we go back to the very start to tie that in, obviously you finished at the highest level, I guess, with Rangers, your boyhood club. But obviously that shows you grew up in Glasgow, obviously such a hotbed of football and football talent, especially when you were a young lad, probably far more than it is today, I guess that's probably fair. Was football something you always aspired to? Was it something you know, how early did it become apparent to you that you had a talent for it that was beyond what others did? And growing up, presumably idolising the Rangers stars of the day, was that your ultimate dream?
Well, when did I realise I could play a bit? Probably when I was about 33 and I was just retiring. Before that, there was too much hard work for me to stay where I was in particular. Now, I was the youngest of four boys and who were all born and bred in Glasgow. We all loved football. We were, as everyone was back in those days, it was all about the weekends and Rangers and Celtic and who was winning and who wasn't. And I kind of grew up as the baby of the family. My brothers were good. I mean, they were really good. If I was to be totally honest, I would say that at the age of, say, 14, 15, my three older brothers were, not arguably, they probably were better than me at that age. But for various reasons, my second brother, the second in line, he did play for Clydebank professionally in the Scottish League, but only for a short time, then emigrated to Canada. But my other two brothers didn't. The one above me, Duncan, was particularly good. He was really good, a midfield player, and I think he could have done something. But as Glasgow was, though, in those days, he got involved with, I was going to say the wrong crowd, but I met all his mates, and they weren't the wrong crowd. They just did things differently. And my brother Dunks got involved with that, and rather than play football on a weekend, he was more intent on going out and enjoying himself, so he never made it. So I guess they kind of subconsciously threw all their dreams at me and said, go on, son, you're the baby. Let's see what you can do. So maybe it was a bit like that.
Was being the younger one then of people who were quite good or very good at football. Did that improve you, I guess, having to compare yourself, battle with them? Were you always trying to prove yourself as the younger child?
Oh, you're always trying to prove yourself. You're the baby, yeah. And you know, we used to have games across from the house on the park, just a piece of waste ground. I say a park, it was a piece of waste ground. And the many, many times I used to go over and just stand there. Because, I mean, as I say, I was the youngest, so I'm 4 or 5 years older than the brother above me, so I was a lot younger than my other two brothers. So I would always sit there and, well, hopefully I'll get a game. But I would always, they'd always put me in goals. Okay, Andy, yeah, you go in goals. You go in goals. You're too small. I was small in those days. I was really small. I wasn't big at all. Not that I'm that big now, but I wasn't. I was particularly frail and what have you. So they used to shove me in goals. But I loved playing, and I just wanted to be involved, and it was just great fun. And I never thought about it, about anything other than playing football. And I don't know when I thought I might be good enough. I know that when I was about 16, I desperately wanted to be a footballer. I remember at school, Kingsridge Senior Secondary was a school, and they used to send in careers officers. Remember, you used to go in and have an hour's meeting with them, and they would go through all these books and these pamphlets and tell you, this is the kind of career you can, you know, go for, and this is what we need to do, and these are the qualifications you need. And I remember walking in, and everybody had been in there like for a minimum of 45 minutes. I was in and out in 2 minutes, because I walked in and he says to me, can I help you, Andy? I says, not unless you've got something in those books that tells me how to be a professional footballer. He went, ah, so you're determined to proceed down that route? I said, absolutely. That's all I want to do. And he says, well, I just wish you the best of luck, and on you go.
Who were your idols then? I guess the Rangers team at the time, it was a strong era for Scottish football, wasn't it? So like, who were your idols? Who were you on the playground?
My hero when I was young, apart from Rangers, you wouldn't be surprised to know, as a Scot, was Dennis Law. I mean, Dennis was this mercurial front man who played for the Manchester United, a giant of a team. And so he was one of my heroes. But at Rangers, there was a guy who we signed in the 60s, a guy called Colin Steen, who came from Hibs and absolutely burst into the scene at Ibrox and started scoring goals for fun. Eventually went to England, went to play for Coventry, Colin. But Colin Steen was my very early hero who I looked up to, because that's what I wanted to do, was play football, score goals, and do what he did.
Okay, well, I think it's always fascinating to me anyway to discover the ways players make their initial breakthrough. You know, it's always an element of being against the odds, if you like, thinking of the sheer number of people hoping to make the grade, especially in a place like Glasgow. Now, how was it you were spotted by Dundee United? Is it correct you actually had more than one trial and didn't get picked up the first time? And then what was that step up like, going from the football you had been playing into, you know, quite a big environment, Dundee United, with Jim McLean, obviously, who was a big famous manager of the Scottish football at that time. Now, what was that step up like? And did you get the sense of being something of a hot property at all?
Do you know what? It all happened so quickly. I remember being on the train when the scout who had watched me many times, a lad called Morris Friel, he's still a pal of mine to this day, Morris, and he had said to Jim McLean, you need to have a look at this guy. You need to have a look at this young kid. He's got something. You'll like him. And I went up and played in a practice match against the first team. Now, I was only maybe 16 at the time. And so I was overawed, totally overawed. Played out in the pitch, Tannadice, against players who had been playing first division football in Scotland. Played hundreds of games. And I was out of my depth. Or I certainly felt out of my depth. And Jim McLean called me and he says, thanks, Andy. Good to see you. But, you know, no thanks, basically, he was saying. We'll let you know. But to be fair to Morris Friel, he kept banging at Jim's door. He said, bring him back up again and play him in a game with kids his own age or just slightly above him. Don't play him against the first team and you'll see. And I went back up and I played in a game where people more my age, maybe they weren't quite my age. They were about 20, 21, but certainly not as old as the first team. And I played, and I played well, and I scored a goal, and I came in, and he just signed me. He said, I'll sign you. And then I remember going up for the first day's pre-season, and I said to my mum and my brothers, I'm going to give myself, now you remember I was just 17, was I? Must have been 73. Yeah, 17. I said to them, I'm going to give myself 4 years to get in the first team. Now, that's how I felt. It sounds ridiculous now when I was in the first team in like 4 weeks, never mind 4 years. But that's how I felt. I was prepared to give it 4 years. And if I didn't make the first team then, my brother had emigrated to Canada, so I was going to go and join him. And then within a couple of months, I was playing first-team football. And I never found the jump that big. I don't know why. Maybe it was just my enthusiasm, my fitness, my effervescence, whatever you want to call it. But I took to it like, you know, like the proverbial duck to water. And I loved every minute of it. But I've never, ever in 17 years of playing the game ever thought of myself as anything other than a football player. Never ever thought myself special in any way. Other people have maybe said so, but I never. And I think that might have been part of the reason I stayed playing as long as I did, was that I always felt I had to fight for my place. Every time I never walked into a dressing room very often and thought, well, I know I'm definitely going to be playing. Maybe a couple of times if I'm being honest. When I really was playing well, maybe a couple of times, but I never ever took it for granted that I'd just be playing. So I think that helped me. But as for going from schoolboy, basically, I went from a schoolboy in July to a first division footballer in Scotland by September. It was ridiculous, but it was brilliant at the same time.
So Andy, what was it like working with Jim McLean?
Jim was brilliant. He was abrasive. He was abrasive as a coach. He never suffered fools gladly. If he thought you weren't doing what you could, then he would let you know. And he wouldn't ask for extra. He would just demand that you gave what he thought you could give, both in performance and in effort. But for me, he saw something in me, and he used to take me out onto the Tannadice in an afternoon when all my mates would be going to the snooker hall or nipping down the pub for a couple of beers and a bit of lunch. I'd be back with Jim, just the two of us, on Tannadice, and he'd be hitting balls at me from all angles, crosses, balls coming short, 40, control, turn and hit, all these sort of little drills that we worked on. And he spent days and months on me, giving me one-to-one coaching like that, which obviously was, in hindsight, was the best thing. You couldn't buy that. In fact, you could never buy it. So although he was abrasive, and if he saw a talent, he was happy to nurture it. And he did that with me without a doubt.
Do you think he helped you become the footballer you eventually became because he was patient with you and worked with you to try and develop your skills?
100%. If it hadn't been for Jim McLean, I would not have achieved half of what I achieved. Not just for the 2 years he spent on the pitch with me, but for his guidance when he spoke to me. And I remember the last thing he said to me, never be satisfied with what you achieve in this game, Andy, because as soon as you are, you'll start to decline. And I took those words with me to Aston Villa, and I used them, and that's how I worked my career, that I was never satisfied with what I achieved. I always wanted something else. I always wanted to try and do more. I always wanted to try and do better. And I took that with me for my career. But there's no doubt Jim McLean was a huge, massive, the biggest influence I had on my career was Jim.
Now, you mentioned there the move south, and you were obviously still a teenager at the point you moved to England. Now, this is a team that just got promoted to the first division as well. It's a bigger setup, I guess, and bigger ambitions than Dundee United, if we're being fair. But obviously, you'd already left Glasgow. You'd left home, moved to a new environment already. But this is a bigger change, I guess, of course. And you're still a teenager at this point. So how, aside from the footballing aspects, you know, how did you settle off the field? You know, were there any issues moving to Birmingham? What was that like? Like, what's the experience as a teenager having to do that?
I understand how some kids might find it daunting and might have trouble with it. I didn't, because as I've said to you, all I ever wanted was to play football. When Villa signed me, and I went down there and I signed for them, and I went to the hotel that night and I met a guy called John Burridge, who had signed the day before me. Budgie was a goalkeeper, in case anyone doesn't know him, and mad as a box of frogs, absolutely nutter. a total nutcase, but professional, dedicated, funny. And we stayed together for 3 or 4 months in a hotel. And I had a couple of Scottish guys who played at Villa then, Bobby McDonald, Jake Finlay in particular, about my age, maybe a couple of years older. And we got pally very quickly. And it was like, it made it easy for me to settle in. For the first 6 months, every other weekend, I was playing at Villa, getting in my car, going home to Glasgow for 2 days, and then coming back again. And I did that for about 6 months. And then I suddenly thought, nah, I can't be doing that now. And I stopped doing it as often because I'd settled in. But I can understand why some guys don't, depending on their personality. Me, on the other hand, I lapped it up. I was lapping up everything there was to be about a professional footballer. Getting up in the morning, going to Bodymore Heath for training, being with the boys, maybe having a couple of beers early in the week with them out, and playing the games in particular at Villa Park, where I'd been used to maybe 10,000 at Tannadice. We're walking out at 40,000 plus, and I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm doing this, and I'm loving it. And I'm actually, what was most surprising for me was I wasn't looking out of place. Actually, it looked like I fitted in quite well. So that was something I was really pleased about.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a spectacular arrival on the scene for, you know, the club as well. Villa finished fourth in the league, I think, in your second season anyway, 76-77. A League Cup win, joint top scorer in the league with Super Mac, then of Arsenal, sadly for me, by that stage. The incredible achievement too, PFA Young Player of the Year and Player of the Year in the same year. Now that puts you, for anyone who's unaware, that puts you in an exclusive club with Cristiano Ronaldo and Gareth Bale.
That's it, yeah.
Obviously, you were way before the lot of them, so you must have felt nigh on invincible at that time.
Do you know what? I remember that night when Ron Saunders wouldn't allow me to go to London. We had played the League Cup final, I think, on the Saturday, and we drew 0-0 with Everton in a turgid game. It was just abysmal. It was horrible. And then we were playing on the Wednesday night, and I had a slight knock. So Saunders said, I'm not letting you go to London. And I said, you can't not let me go. This is important. This is like your peers saying you're the best. So he wouldn't let me go, wouldn't shift, wouldn't budge. Even though Derek Dugan said to him, we'll take Andy, we'll pick him up at his door in a car, we'll drive him to the hotel, we'll walk him in, we'll sit him down, we'll present the award. Then, now, Derek didn't tell me I'd won both at that time. I only thought I'd won one. And he says, and then we'll have him back up the road, back in Birmingham by midnight. I promise you, Ron. Saunders says, no. But that was Ron Saunders for you. And then Derek called me and said, Andy, I've got a favour to ask. And anyone who knows me will understand what I'm saying here. He says, would you mind giving up one of the trophies? And I went, what do you mean? He said, well, you've won both. You've won the Young Player of the Year and the Player of the Year. I went, what? And anyone who knows me will know and won't be surprised that I nearly said yes to accommodate them so that their night wouldn't be a bad one and they would have someone. I think Peter Barnes had finished second. He said, we'd like to give the Young Player of the Year to Peter Barnes. And I said, can you give me a minute to think about it, Derek? And call me back. So he called me back and I suddenly thought, do you know what? No. And I'm it's not like me. I said, if I've won both of these, it's such an accolade. He said, but no one will ever know if you give one away that you won both. And I thought, well, that's not fair on me. So I said, no. I said, I'm sorry, Derek. I think if I've won both, that I should have both, even though I'm not with you. And it's not my fault. So I did, and little did I know it would be, what, another 30 years or something like that, maybe longer, before Cristiano Ronaldo was the next one to do it. So I'm so happy that I did say, for once in my life, I stood my ground and said, no, I think if I've won them, Derek, I'm going to have both of them. And it was it's an amazing anyone, it's like anything. If you get voted the best at by people you play against or work with and work against every week, that's something special that can never be replicated. Really can.
Absolutely. Andy, I mean, that season 76-77, you played in that 5-1 victory over Liverpool where you were 5-1 up at half time. Was that the best game you ever played for Villa?
For Villa, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned for Villa, because there has been one other that beat that, and I think you know which one I'm talking about. we might talk about it later, but no, that night at Villa Park, it was a midweek, and that night we were absolutely out of this world. This was a really good Liverpool side who went on to win the league that year as well, but we blew them away in 45 minutes of just the most amazing football, and it's sad that it wasn't covered by even Central TV. I don't know why they didn't cover it, but they didn't. And it was just, you know, myself, I got two, John Dean got two, Brian Little got one. You know, we played with a front three. People thought you didn't play with a front three in those days. Well, actually, we did. And it was amazing. And Liverpool just, I could see the players, and they were all seasoned pros who knew the business, and they were just blown away by our performance. And it's no surprise that we never got a goal in the second half. I think was, you know, everybody had put so much into it. But it was, I find it hard to think about a Villa performance that I played in that could match that.
Now, obviously, we mentioned the 77 League Cup final. That was something of an epic going to three games. Now, you were playing in two of them and then injured for the decisive one, unfortunately. When Paul, this must be a game you remember as well, I'm sure, or a series of games from the Everton perspective. You probably didn't like Andy Gray in those days.
Well, I always liked Andy because he knew he was a good footballer. I mean, as Evertonians, you always recognise good footballers for opposition teams as part of being an Everton fan. But I'm just being nice here. But I went to all three. I went to all three finals. It was my last year at university, and so I took and rejig things to go there. But yeah, Andy was right about the first final. The first final at Wembley was absolutely awful. And why it wasn't extra time, I've no idea. The second final, the first replay at Hillsborough, I remember Latchford, because obviously ex-Birmingham City player, when he equalised in the last minute of normal time and he celebrated for the Villa fans, don't think that went down too well.
It probably didn't.
And, I don't really want to talk about the Old Trafford game. Chris Nichols won the goal. That mistake that let in Brian Little to score the winning goal, it was heartbreaking. But, you know, Villa at that time, and Ron Saunders in particular, I think he'd won the League Cup three times in 3 years with three different clubs. So the League Cup almost had Villa's name written on it.
Yeah, he did Man City, Norwich, and then Villa, yeah. Saunders won it with those three. That's right. So, yeah. But no, we had a good side then, you're right. I think we were better than the Toffees then. And I think in the first game, I think you know, Everton were frightened of us. I think, because we'd played so well all season. I think they were wary of us and they were really negative. I think they grew in confidence at the next two games, but there's nothing you can do when Chris Nichols smashes in one like that from the halfway line almost to help winning it. And Terry Daricourt, I used to take the mickey out of Terry when I went to Everton, and I used to say to him a lot, Terry, listen, why didn't you clear that one when it was coming across the 6-yard box? And he says to me, because he was scared of scoring an own goal. So he stepped away from it, as you will know only too well. He stepped away from it, Paul, and it let Brian Little slide it in. But no, we were a good side then, and Villa were a really good side, really good side. But that was not a final that you would say was a classic. Any of the games.
I mean, what's the frustration for you that Villa team was so good that it never really went on after the League Cup win during your time there?
Well, I mean, I think it could have done. And it might have done, but you know, as far as I was concerned, I fell out with Ron Saunders very soon after that, and we didn't see eye to eye after that until I went. So I think the grounding was there for that team, and I think you could see where the title win that came fairly shortly after that, and then the Champions League or the European Cup win, that was all based on that team. A lot of that team I played with in the mid-70s. You know, Dennis Mortimer was there, Alan Evans was there, Nigel Spinks was there, Gary Williams was there, Gary Shaw was there. You know, they were all there when I was there. So the footings were there, the foundations were there for Villa to go on. It's just that I wasn't going to be part of it, and that was, you know, that was my decision. After falling out with Saunders, I couldn't play for him again. And as I say, I wasn't one of those that could say I'll accept that and I'll just play for you. Now, as soon as we crossed, that was me. I had to go, had to leave. I didn't want to. I had four unbelievable years at Villa there, and why would I have wanted to have left? I won things as a team and individually. that I never thought I would. I was playing unbelievable football. So there was no need for me to try and get out of Villa. But when Saunders and I crossed swords, I'm sorry, I couldn't play for him again. And I told him that, and therefore I had to go.
Now, on this theme then, we've run Saunders. Sorry, Paul. Now, is this, I mean, I've got several examples that I think, well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, of various incidents that have led to this breakdown. I might be doing either of you a disservice, but, you know, we've already mentioned the awards night that he stopped you from going. In 77, I think it was, you were taken off in the final game of the season where you had the chance to become the sole top scorer. You'd already scored a hat-trick, I think, and you still had time to go on and become top scorer in your own right. He took you off. He stopped you going on a Scotland tour of South America in 1977, the summer tour, the chance to play at the Maracanã, but probably more importantly, the chance to sort of get more embedded in the Scottish squad a year out from a World Cup. The following season didn't take you to Barcelona for a UEFA Cup tie when, you know, you'd been injured, but you were going to be okay in time for the game and you were a key part of the squad. You know, correct me if I misrepresented any of that, but that's the stuff I've found in reading about this. And is this a case of a manager focused on, I don't know, in his mind, the collective possibly, and he's unable to deal with, to some extent, the tension that was coming your way? I'm not saying for a moment that you sought any of this. It's just it was coming naturally through your achievements, your goals, how much impact you were having as a player. Is that how it went, possibly?
Yeah, that's exactly how it went, in my opinion. Ron was one for the collective, and I bought into that. I was part of that. I was part of the collective. But if the collective are going to do well, then it's going to need one or two individuals to do exceptionally well. And I happened to be that one. And I was getting headlines. And obviously, people would come in after the game and say, can we talk to you, Andy? And he got, fuck it, Andy again. Why not talk to Frank Carradas? He's had a fantastic game. And they said, well, nobody wants to hear from Frank Carradas, with the greatest respect, Ron. They want to hear what Andy's got to say. He's just scored two or three goals. Whatever. He couldn't get his head around that, Saunders. He really, really couldn't get his head around that. And I don't know why, because there was no one more of a team player, as Paul will tell you as well, throughout my life than me. I always played for the benefit of the team, not for the benefit of me, but for the benefit of the team. And I couldn't get my head around that. And then when he took me off in that game when I had a chance, I'd scored the hat-trick, you're right, against West Brom. And when he took me off, and I've gone, why are you taking me off? And I'll tell you in the dressing room. He says, come here. And I went into a little room. It might have been the showers. And he says, I've taken you off because I don't want you to go on the Scottish tour. I said, you must be joking. I said, it's fucking South America. It's Brazil. It's like, you know, these things don't come around very often. It's the Maracanã. He said, no. You need to rest in the summer so you're ready to go again at the beginning of next year. Now, had I been 4 or 5 years older, I'd have told him to shove it and I'm going on the tour. But because I was a baby, I was learning my trade, and I respected everything he said and thought he was doing it for me. He was actually doing it for himself. I said, okay, that. So he says, so I'm going to tell everybody you've got an ankle injury and you've had it for 5 or 6 weeks and we're going to take the summer to rest you and that'll be that. And I thought, well, okay. So I did, and I missed an amazing trip, and it might have cost me many caps. I'm not sure. But, yeah, that was the kind of thing Ron did with me. And then when he never took me to Barcelona, the story's a belter, if you've got time. We'd drawn 2-2 at Villa Park against Cruyff's Barcelona. And I'd never played the first leg either. So I'm getting treatment on the Sunday. The game's not till the Wednesday. So I've got like a thigh strain or something. But I'm going to be all right. I could have played on the Wednesday. So he comes in on the Sunday. He's never come into training on the Sunday ever to see injured players. He hated being around injured players. If you were injured, you were no use to him. That was his philosophy. If you're fit, come and I'll embrace you. If you're not fit, disappear. Don't come back to me till you're fit. So he comes in the Sunday and I'm sitting there with Jim Walker, I think it was, physio. So he says to me, how are you? I said, yeah, good. It's looking good. I think I'll be good. No. How are you today? I says, well, it's Sunday. He said, could you play today? I says, no, of course I fucking could. It's fucking Sunday. But I think I'll be all right for Wednesday. Well, if you can't tell me you can play today, I'm not taking you. And Jim Walker looked at me with a blank look that said, you must be mad. He's our best player. And you're not going to take him. when him and I, Jim the physio and I, knew I would be fit to play on the Wednesday. And we got beat, like 2-1. Now, I'm not saying I would have made a difference, but I did in those days, and I might have done. But it also, you denied me the opportunity to play against Barcelona in their own ground, which was another one I saw. And I don't know, maybe it was deliberate, I don't know. But then he accused me of cheating the Villa fans after that game. Some months down the line, a reporter, a pal of mine, said to me, he had to go at you on the plane on the way back. He said that you cheated the fans and the players. And I said, what? Me who's had injections into his groin, into his stomach, into his knee, into every part of my body, when Saunders asked me to go and play football for him, he's accused me of cheating. So I went to see him and I says, I'm never playing for you again. You can piss off. Sorry, I'm not meant to swear, but I said, you can piss off. In fact, I use stronger language than that. I said, I can't play for you again. I really can't. And that was it.
Wow, fantastic. This is the kind of insight that you just don't hear about. It doesn't all come out in this way. It's the story, as you say, he can put out into the news his version of it, and then, unless you get the right to reply in the media, it's hard to counter it, isn't it, at the time?
Yeah.
Especially as a young man, as you say, at this point, it's very hard against an authority figure as strong as he was, obviously. On a slightly lighter note from your time at Villa. Oh, sorry, yeah, go on, Paul. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just one thing to ask, Andy. I mean, you mentioned John Burridge before. I remember reading the quote that John Burridge said about Ron Saunders. The difference between me and him was I had a personality, he didn't.
He didn't, yeah. That went around a lot with Ron. I mean, listen, Ron Saunders, I wouldn't sit here and say I hated every minute with Ron Saunders. I didn't. And I wouldn't sit here and say he never taught me things. He did. He was an old centre-forward himself from his playing days. Not top bracket, but he was a centre-forward. And he taught me a few of the dark arts about playing centre-forward in those days when you have to look after yourself. And he was good for me because he worked me hard as well. So I'm not saying everything was bad about Saunders, but he definitely didn't like any player getting headlines. People want to talk to him. Talk to us about Andy. What about the rest of the boys? There's 10 of them. And you go, yeah, we know that, but we don't want to talk to them. So he was good for me in a lot of ways, but he couldn't quite get his head around the fact that people wanted to talk to me and nobody else in the team. When there were, he was right, there were another 10 or even more really good players on that side. But I wouldn't have minded. That's a daft thing. Saunders came to me and said, I don't want you to talk to these lads. Can someone else do it? I'd be like, yeah, of course you can. Not a problem. Not a problem.
So I take it, Andy, he wasn't very pleased when you opened the Zoom nightclub.
Do you know what? The opposite. And you'll be surprised after the way we've just talked about him. It was the one thing that Ron Saunders did for me that was totally out of character. We were playing Bolton, I think, on the Wednesday night, and the club was opening that night. And he came to me before the game. He says, listen, I know your club's opening. And I thought he was going to give me a bollocking. He says, and the boys are coming down after. I said, yeah, I'm hoping the boys will come down in the future after I win. He said, well, here's the deal. If we're winning comfortably at halftime and you've scored, I'll take you off and you can go down to your club. I said, sorry? He says, that's the deal. If we're winning comfortably, you've scored, I'll take you off at halftime and you can go down and open the club. So, of course, we were winning comfortably. I think we were 3-0 up. Yes, I had scored. So when I came in at halftime and I started getting my gear off, the boys were going, Where are you going? I says, I'm going down to open the club, lads. I said, now don't fuck it up. I've got 3-0 up here. Don't mess it up and lose this game. Otherwise, I'm never happy. So I went down, left the guys to, I think we won 3-0. I don't think the scoreline changed. And the next minute they were down. But that's the one thing where Ron Saunders actually did something like that for me or anybody else, really, which was really out of character.
Yeah, I mean, that absolutely is. I mean, at that time as well, Andy, you were kind of friends with Black Sabbath, weren't you? Geezer Butler, people like that. I mean, that must have been some experience for you.
That was amazing. I met Geezer and Tony Iommi, two of the original band members in Birmingham at a nightclub, surprisingly. And I got friendly with the boys, particularly Tony. Geezer was a big Villa fan, Butler. He was a big Villa fan, but Tony wasn't into football really. So, but for some reason, I got pally with Tony. And then that summer, I had an injury and I was coming back from injury. And they invited me over to Bel Air, come to Los Angeles for a holiday, Andy. And I went, well, okay then. So I jumped on the plane, got to there, and I went and I walked outside the airport. There's this limousine, 60 feet long, was sitting there, and the doors opened, and Tony stepped out and said, taxi for Mr. Gray? And I'm going, I said, taxi, I could live in that. Jesus. And off we went, and honestly, it was another world. The boys were great. They looked after me. I went training up and down Beverly Hills every day. I was up and down those hills, and they are hills, I can tell you. And then we had good times at night, and they were there. I enjoyed them, good company. But that's what happens when you're a footballer. It's one of the perks, is that you get to meet other people from different spheres of life, you know, from entertainment industry, from the music industry, from the TV industry. You get the opportunity to meet people, and some of them do become pals and are really good people. And that was the case with Sabbath. They were brilliant. I've seen them a few times since, obviously, but they were great. And that is one of the perks of being like a footballer, and even more so now, that the players get to rub shoulders with the high and the great and the good of any kind of industry in the world.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, before we move on from Villa to Wolves, then just we touched on it briefly about the international aspect. And it's obviously a good point to bring this in, because obviously the 1978 World Cup, you didn't end up making the cut for the squad. Now, obviously the impact of the 77 tour might have been quite significant on that. Do you think that was one of the key factors why you missed out? You know, this is a time where you were, as we talked about, player of the year, well, from the year before, but, you know, still at that point, player of the year in fine form. Scotland obviously had a lot of talent at this time. This is true, but, you know, you were perfectly in that company. Is this the World Cup, you know, to spoiler alert, you know, you didn't get to go to a World Cup at all with Scotland. Is this the one that stung the most?
Without a doubt, yeah. Without a doubt. 78 was, it was a time, as you say, where I'd had a couple of injuries that season, but I'd still got 20 odd league goals, I think, and I'd played in 40 games, so there was no issue with my fitness. Ali McLeod, God rest his soul, was our manager, and he came to West Brom to watch me play the last game of the season. And I only know this because many years later Big Ron told me, when I was his coach, and he said to me, did I ever tell you the story about Ali McLeod coming to you, watch you? I said, no. He says, yeah, he came into my office in the last game of the season. And he said, I said to him, what are you down here for? He said, well, I'm down to see wee bud, Willie Johnson. Down to see wee bud, make sure he's okay. And he said, oh, he's buzzing, wee bud's ready to go. He says, and I've just got to make my mind up about Andy Gray. And Ron said, what mind? I said to him, what mind? He said, well, whether I take him or not. He said, oh, really? Oh, okay. So we left it at that, Ron. So we won 3-0. Although I didn't score, I ran them ragged. I had one of my better games without ever scoring a goal. And Big Ron said to me, when Ali McLeod walked into my office after that, I said to him, well, that's a very easy decision you've got to make, isn't it, son? Meaning, he'll pick me. He can't not pick me. And he said, Ron said, he kind of looked shifty and he kind of half laughed, and eventually he left. And I remember sitting at Edgbaston, Five Ways, in a mate's wine bar when the squad was getting announced, and he wanted to get champagne out because everybody was convinced I was going. Everybody. Everybody. And there was something in the back of my mind, I don't know why, where I thought, he's not going to take me. And my mate, I said, don't bring any champagne out now. Just leave it. I don't want any. And my mate went round the back, as in those days, we had the phones and we tellies and that. You had to go and find it somewhere on the radio or something. And he came back in and said, I could tell by the look in his face, I wasn't in the group, wasn't in the squad. And he says, you're not in it, you're one of the four subs. I went, yeah, I thought I might be. And that was devastating. Devastating. And it was hard to take. It was hard to take. I mean, 82 and 86 were less hard to take. But still, you know, the night Jock Steen died and we qualified for that World Cup in Cardiff, I'd been involved in all the games. And I think if Jock had not passed away that night, I'd have gone to that World Cup. I think I was 86 when he played Sharpie and I at the end of the season, I think against Iceland away. We won 1-0. And I thought, well, we've got a chance here again. I've got a chance to get a World Cup. But then Jock sadly had the heart attack in Cardiff. and passed away, and Fergie took over. Whatever reason. Maybe it's because I turned down Fergie when I was a kid. I don't know. Would Fergie bear a grudge? I don't know. But anyway, it was said. I think there was definitely three World Cups I was capable of going to. 78, I should have gone. 82, less so, because Wolves were in dire straits in 82. But then 86, after Everton, I had a real chance of going as well. But the fact I didn't go at all, if there's one blemish on my footballing stats, it's that I can't ever say. I played in so many qualifying matches, so many of them. World Cup qualifying match. I've had to get sent off in one in Prague. And I played so many of them, but for some reason, destiny just never dealt me the cards to go to a World Cup. But she dealt me a lot of good cards, so I'm not complaining.
Now, Paul, I mean, obviously it's clear that 20 caps for a player of Andy's calibre doesn't do him justice. Or he may not say it himself in quite that terms, but I mean, I think that's clear to me, someone who didn't live through all of those years. Well, wasn't aware, was too young for some of them. But, you know, it's clear to me that Andy was plenty good enough for more caps than that. What are your thoughts?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Andy, you always kind of thought that being sent off in that game in Czechoslovakia kind of turned the selectors against you a little bit. Is that still what you think?
No, I think what happened, if you remember in those days, there weren't many internationals played and not competitive internationals played. And if you remember, the World Cup qualifying was spread over 2 years, basically. Now, what happened, because I got sent off in a World Cup qualifier, banned me for the World Cup qualifying matches, and they banned me for 4 games. And those 4 games spanned about 18 months to 2 years. So there was no point picking me for any friendlies we played because I couldn't play in the competitive matches that were coming up. So I basically had a 2-year chunk when I was right in my prime where I wasn't looked at. Nobody could, you know, I was suspended, so there was no point picking me. I couldn't play. So that was a costly mistake. When I chinned Anton Ondrus in Prague that night, that was a very costly mistake.
Because you look at your goal scoring record for Scotland, I think you scored 7 goals in 20 games. I mean, that's better than any modern striker come close to this century, I think.
Well, no, I mean, I'd have got more. I think there's no doubt I'd have got more. I mean, the one thing I'd always say, like, I always thought that when I played for Scotland, I played a lot with Kenny, and Kenny Dalglish, who was just out of this world. But the one thing I'd always said about then, and there was people like Joe Jordan, I think Derek Johnson, who was at Rangers, and people talked about Big Joe. But if you look at Big Joe, probably got nearly 3 times more caps than me. But if I'd had the same caps as Joe Jordan, I'd have scored about 4 or 5 times more goals than Joe. I know I would, because I knew I was a goal scorer. Joe was a great front man, great leader of the line, but he wasn't a prolific goal scorer. Even at Leeds, he wasn't a prolific. In Man United, he got his share and he got big goals. But I would always believe that if, at the beginning of every season, I'd get more goals than Joe Jordan. That's what I thought. So I thought I'd be in the team, but others thought otherwise. Well, Ali McLeod thought otherwise, particularly in that one. But who am I? Who am I to argue with him?
Did Ali McLeod ever contact you after the World Cup at all just to talk about his reasons why he didn't pick you, or did he just not bother at all?
He called me up. The first game we played after the World Cup, when we had that disaster in Argentina, we played Austria away. And funny enough, I was in the team, started the game, scored in Vienna, scored one of the goals. And I thought to myself, well, it's ridiculous. You know, I missed all that. First game back, I'm in the side, scored a goal. I think me and Doug Leash played up front and we were pretty good that night. I think we lost 3-2 though. We played really well. But I just thought, and I never felt, you know, that's showing him because I scored. I never felt that. I'm just delighted to score for my country. But I never thought that vindicated me in any way. I wasn't looking for that. And I wasn't looking for an apology from him, and I wasn't looking for a reason. He's a coach. He made the decision not to take me. And I don't know if it would have made any difference. It might have done. Who knows? We don't know. But no excuses, no phone calls, no reasons. In fact, I don't know what reason he could have, and that's probably why he felt maybe he couldn't give me one because I can't think of giving me. But you know, that's what they get paid for, to make these decisions. Shame. It was a shame, but never mind.
You mentioned the 86 and obviously Alex Ferguson being in charge by then. And I'm sure you've spoken to him a number of times over the years in your broadcasting roles. Did you ever ask him why you didn't get to go?
No. Do you know what? Again, no. Fergie, I'd obviously, even with doing my Sky work for 20 years, and obviously Fergie was in his pomp then, we crossed swords plenty of times, Fergie and I. A lot of time we didn't see eye to eye, or we didn't agree with everything that was going on. And no, I remember, in fairness to Fergie, he did call me and he told me himself, man to man, which I appreciated. He just felt that at 86 that I maybe hadn't done enough. And he's probably right, because after I left Everton, I had a pretty average season back at Villa. And so he was probably right, but I just thought that maybe, because I'd been involved in all the qualifying games, that maybe I'd sneak in. And I think if Jock had still been coach then, I think I would have done. But Fergie, not. You know what Fergie's like. That's what made him a great coach. He would cut you off and put somebody else in. But if he thought that was for the betterment of the team. So when you look at what you achieved at 25 years at United, you can't really argue with that, can you?
Not really, not really. I know to my cost as a Newcastle fan what he's achieved with Man United. But there we go. Well, let's not get into all of that. Now, well, getting back to the club scene then. So following, obviously, the breakdown of relations at Villa, you moved to a local-ish rival, I guess, for a record transfer fee to Wolves. So what was it that made you choose Wolves? And how did you deal with the pressure? Or was there any pressure that you felt because of the transfer fee? And also, as a follow-up, is it true that you actually failed your medical but signed anyway?
Yeah, already signed. I'll deal with the why Wolves. Well, quite simply, Saunders had priced me out the market for anyone else to buy me. He didn't want me to leave. So he thought, if I ask for a record transfer fee, because if you back in those days, don't know if you remember, there was a £500,000 ceiling on every deal in Europe at that particular time. No one could pay more than £500,000. They were trying to control... spiralling out of control. So the only teams that could come in for me were English teams. They sold Steve Daly to Man City for 1.4 million. And that gave John Barman an opportunity to spend that. And he called me up and said, I want to take you to Wolves. And I was so desperate to get out of Villa that I said, okay, I went and met him. I liked Barney. He was a good lad, liked him, good football man with Richie Barker. And he said to me, you know, we're looking to build, we're looking to spend. They bought Dave Thomas from Everton. He said to me, I'm going to get you Dave Thomas, because he had been like a supply line for Bob Latchford at Goodison for so many years. He said, I'm going to go and get you Dave Thomas. And that never worked out for Dave, sadly. And he went and got other players, brought in Emlyn Hughes, who was at the end of his career, but his experience was just unbelievable, and brought in one or two players. So it looked like things were happening. We finished fourth that first season, I remember it. I think it was fourth or fifth at Wolves, and won the League Cup. So I'm thinking after a year, you know, I've made the right decision here. But sadly, the club was in, well, it was up the creek without a paddle. It was potless. It had no money. It had built this huge stand that it couldn't really pay for. Went in the administration. 2 and 3 years of yo-yo football. Down, up, down. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And it didn't look like there was, in fact, there wasn't anything that I could do about it. Because we had quite an old team. Great pros. People like John Richards, Willie Carr, Emlyn Hughes, Jeff Palmer, Derek Parkin. These were all older professionals, but great lads, but at the end of their careers. And I was 28, I think, 27, 28. So I probably was coming to the end of mine. So the first couple of years were terrific at Wolves. It really looked promising. The second two were dreadful, dreadful. Wouldn't want to go through it again. The day I signed, you mentioned the thing about the medical. And I remember John Barnwell coming in. He has office underneath the stand, this old wooden stand at Molyneux. And he said to me, The docs says you failed your medical. He says, your knee, how is it? I said, knee's fine. said, before I, is he sure? I said, yeah, I'm positive, I'll be fine. So he went out, and he went to the chairman, he said, don't sign Andy now on the pitch. He said, that you won't have my, I'll be resigning first thing in the morning. So the chairman crapped himself, and Barney got his, and we strolled out onto the pitch and signed the relevant ball out there. And that was the reason, yeah, that was the talk about not passing a medical, which was par for the course for my career, because it's an even better story for Toffees when they finish with this one. Wow, even better.
Now, obviously, you mentioned there more silverware with the League Cup win in 1980. You scored the only goal, the easiest goal you'd probably ever score, I think, was against Nottingham Forest. Now, this was a Forest team, obviously, between their two European Cup wins, I guess a couple of months away from the second of those. So that, regardless of how the goal came about, must have been one hell of a, it was a fabulous victory. It must have been one hell of a memorable triumph. What are your memories of that Cup final in particular?
My memories, they battered us. They were miles better than us. You've talked about it. They were about to become double European Cup champions back-to-back. They had better players than us. They were younger than us. But a cup final is a cup final, and I'd played in a few, and you just don't know. You know, we rode our luck. Paul Bradshaw, our goalkeeper, got lucky a couple of times. But we were always in the game. We always felt we were in the game and that we just need one chance. And we knew, I always thought Schultz was a bit susceptible to balls coming in aerially into his box, because Schultz wasn't the biggest goalkeeper by any stretch. And I used to always batter him a couple of times early on when we played, and I don't think he liked it. But we always thought if we got a chance and took it, we could hang on. But it was without a doubt a game where you would look back on it and think, how on earth did Wolves win that game? But it doesn't matter, because the history books just say Wolves won, Forest nil, scorer great. It doesn't tell you, poxy goal, couldn't miss it, big mistake from the centre-back and the goalkeeper, and anyone would have scored that. Doesn't say all, just says Gray scorer.
Perfect. Now, obviously, you mentioned the last couple of years at Wolves as being awful. Now, there was a relegation, obviously, with Wolves coinciding, which must annoy you, as you mentioned, with Villa's European Cup triumph at that same time. Now, I don't want to sort of just question about whether how you felt missing that, because I think we could all appreciate that you've been a part of that and how that must have felt to some extent, even though the relationship had obviously gone. But what you then went on to achieve with Everton, and we'll get into that in more detail in a sec, does and you may never have ended up at Everton had you stayed at Villa. So do you feel, does what you achieved at Everton make the fact that you missed Villa's biggest era a bit of a moot point? I know it's not quite the same competition, but you may not have gone down that path and achieved all you did with Everton.
If you asked me to swap what we did at Everton for what I might have been involved with Villa, no chance. I would never have swapped that for the world. Absolutely never. No. And I never took that on. I was delighted that Villa as a club had won the league, and they won the league. Obviously, I'd have liked to have done that with Wolves, but it wasn't to be. And the fact that Tony Barton had taken over and it wasn't Saunders, maybe I would have felt a little bit more aggrieved if it had been Saunders who took them to the European Cup final and won it. But it was Tony Barton who I liked. Tony was a lovely man and one of the nice men in football who he was and a nice man in football who got his rewards. But no, I never felt envious or jealous or anything like that. I just thought, well done. You've done what you deserved. You've won that, and that's absolutely brilliant. But I never went to work every morning thinking, I wish I was back there. No, not once.
Can I just ask Andy about your time at Wolves as well? I mean, I often watch reruns of the big match on Saturday mornings, and I watched a game from the early 80s with you playing with Wayne Clark and the Wolves team. Now, I never realised you and Wayne Clark actually played together, and I was just wondering, did you ever have any kind of influence on his career in terms of tips and training advice, stuff like that?
No, do you know, Wayne Clark, obviously from a very famous footballing family, I always thought he underachieved with the skill that he had, and what he achieved as a footballer was way below what he should have achieved. And I call Wayne, Wayne to me was like a Monday to Friday footballer. He'd be brilliant Monday to Friday in training. He'd do everything, score goals from unbelievable angles. And a Saturday, not sure. So he should have achieved much, much more. He really should. He had everything he needed. He was tall. He was athletic. He had brilliant touch of the football. It never embarrassed him. He was that good. So if you give somebody those skills and he doesn't achieve what he should, then something in his head's not right. Maybe he didn't want it as much. Maybe he never had the desire I had. I mean, he was twice as skillful as me. I would have killed for that skill that he had with the football. I would have killed for it. But I achieved much more out of the game than he did because I drove myself to do that. And I don't know if Wayne did. He maybe just relied on his ability to get him there. But an unbelievably talented footballer who I think should have achieved more.
We'll leave things there for the end of part one of this Andy Gray episode, but there'll be plenty more to come in part two, where the focus will switch to Everton and the glory years there and beyond with Aston Villa again and Rangers, and of course, Andy's career with Sky and broadcasting and all that followed there. So do join us again for episode two of this Andy Gray episode.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.